My name is Michael Coates. I'm a former firefighter, but I'm also a former soldier. And it's the stories from the individuals within this military community that I'm desperate to document. Our next guest is a British psychiatrist who has dedicated his life to his profession. His research has seen advances in the treatment of chronic fatigue syndrome, as well as military mental health. A former president of the Royal College of Psychiatrists, a trustee of combat stress, who has a deep-rooted passion for the history and understanding of PTSD and shell shock. Episode 30, Simon Wesley. This is Declassified. Was you born in Sheffield?
Yep.
1956?
Yep.
What was childhood like?
Yeah, no, I had it. I mean, where are you from, by the way? You sound like...
Hull.
You're from Hull? Last time my dad moved, ended up.
But, oh, yeah. Really?
No, I mean, my father came as a child, a refugee from Czechoslovakia. So he's one of what was called Nicky Winton's children. So there were 600 Jewish children who were saved by Nicky Winton in 1939. And he ended up in Hull, in fact.
From the kinder transport?
Yeah, he was a kinder transport kid. That's what he was. Mm. Came when he was 13, went to Liverpool Street station and spent 5 nights in a brothel in the East End, which I think life went downhill for him ever since, actually, but he did. And then he went to stay with a family in Hull, where you're from, and spent the war there, joined in 1944, joined the Navy, which he's not a warlike military person, but he served for a year, served on D-Day in a ship, was sunk twice, but survived. And in a way, that was actually the most traumatic thing that happened to him, because people say he was a Holocaust survivor, because he wasn't, he escaped.
Mm.
And then after the war, he went back to Czechoslovakia to find out what had happened to his parents and family, and they'd all been murdered. So he came back to Hull, and indeed he was then adopted by that family, who became my grandparents when I arrived.
Really?
And in Cottingham.
Oh, my dad used to live in Cottingham.
Yeah, they live right by the church in Cottingham.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he moved to Sheffield as a teacher. So he taught languages, which I always thought was a cheat, because he spoke about 5 languages anyway. And when I was a little boy, I said, well, my father doesn't work, he just speaks languages.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he met my mum, and then they settled in Sheffield, and that's where I was born. And they lived there for the next 60 years in the same house.
Did he speak about things like the kinder transport or the early part? Was it, what was
yeah.
it? What...
I mean, he did. I mean, it wasn't, I mean, he, it wasn't, people keep often, when I've done interviews before about my father, people want to make more of it, in the sense that, I mean, it changed him as a person, that's true. He was a natural pessimist. He assumed that the world would be bad. But it wasn't the biggest issue we had. I mean, you know, there were one or two things where I wasn't allowed to watch the bit of World at War on the camps, because he did find that very upsetting. But no, it was a thing I knew about. I mean, he remembered leaving Czechoslovakia quite well. He was 13. But obviously, his story then changes. He settles in Britain. Indeed, the thing that he didn't talk much about was his actual direct war experience. He had a terrible night when his ship, his job was to listen to German transmissions, because his German was perfect. In fact, he worked with Miliband's brother's father, who also was a fluent German speaker. And they were sunk. And that's what he didn't like talking about. And for the rest of his life, he would have nightmares about that night in the North Sea when the ship had overturned. They'd been torpedoed. And they'd hit a mine and they'd overturned. But I often talk about him with veterans to make the point my father didn't have PTSD. He was well. He just had nightmares about once a month. My mum would tell me about them. And he lost all his hair when he was 18. So he went completely bald when he was 18 from the shock. And but he was fine. He didn't have a psychiatric disorder. He would have been pretty unhappy if someone had said he had, or asked him to see a social worker or something. He'd had a bad war or a bad night. And he remembered it for the rest of his life. He never forgot about it.
Mm.
And then later on in life, partly through me, he started meeting naval people who obviously kept, you know, were really loved to meet him, because they're, you know, there's this big bond, which my father didn't really feel until he got to about 70. And then as I started to meet admirals and things like that, and they would say, oh, Mr. Wesley, it's fantastic to meet you, and they want to take you on a submarine or all this stuff, because they meant it.
Yeah.
I kept saying, do you mean that? Of course, we'll send a car and all this stuff. And he quite liked that. And then he was blind by this time. Not a war injury at all. It was glaucoma. But he did then, after my mother died, he got very lonely, and we had to change our house for him. But in between, he spent time with St. Dunstan's, who were lovely. Mm. But he was not a military person, you know.
So the military. I know we're jumping forward a little bit now, but so the military influence as a child didn't influence your decision making. Going into psychiatry.
If you'd met my father, you would never have met a less military person. He was a linguist. He was Jewish. My mother was Anglican, but he was culturally quite Jewish. He had an accent, and he didn't talk about the war experience he'd had, but he did talk about politics. And from him, I got a lot of my politics were kind of leftish. Very, you know, I'm glad he died before we had the referendum. Really, I am. He was a very, very European and really believed in European unity as a way of stopping the horrors of history, which had affected him, repeating itself. And we spent a lot of time in Europe as a kid.
Seeing it at that point of view and especially with things like Alf Dubs now. And
yeah,
and
what he was on the same train as Alf.
Really?
Yeah, he was on the same train, yeah.
I didn't know that. So that's how far my research has gone. I mean, that's amazing. I mean, we've covered the kind of refugee crisis on this podcast, and the similarities are shocking. And I just feel like we're just forgetting this
stuff.
We are.
You know? I mean, it's the 80th anniversary of the Kinder Transport last year, and there was a big celebration and commemoration. And part of it was to remember the past, obviously. And there's still quite a few of Nicky Winton's over 620 kids. There's still about 70, 80 alive. My dad passed away 4 years ago. But part of it was to celebrate the contributions they'd made to our life and our national life. And my father was a very modest man, but there were plenty there who'd really made major contributions. My father had, in his own quiet way, done a lot in Sheffield in charity work, which is where he met Nick Winton, actually, not knowing who he was, and in the music scene in Sheffield. But we're doing more this year, again, to point out that immigrants almost invariably give far more to this country than they take. And my father owed his life to this country without any shadow of doubt. There's no doubt about that. And was always unbelievably grateful and repaid it many times over. And it's, you know, it's a story I don't tire of telling. And my wife, who's a much more famous doctor than I am, who led our GPs for some time, I remember saying during the referendum campaign, when there was this kind of thing about immigrants filling up casualty and destroying our NHS, she said that when you go to casualty, when you go to A&E, you're much more likely to be treated by an immigrant than you are to be sitting next to one. She couldn't actually prove that was true, actually, but I'm absolutely certain it's true. Mm. And that's been a theme, and that I got from my father.
Yeah, and you went into psychiatry in the 70s?
80s, yeah.
Oh, was it 80s? So you started your training in the 70s?
I went to medical school in 75 with no ambition to be a psychiatrist at all. There were no doctors in my family. To this day, I don't know why I decided when I was 15 to do medicine. I honestly, truly don't know. Because I didn't have any role models at all. And in fact, I was much better on the arts side. My really strong subjects, partly because of my father and my mum, were music, history, things like that. But I then went to medical school, and you want to be a doctor, and you want to do all the running around and the doctor bits, which I did, which I loved and I enjoyed. But I found that I was actually more attracted to psychiatry, and that wasn't very fashionable. In fact, it was extremely unfashionable. But I did my what we call medical membership, and I did cardiology to do all those things that, you know, doctors do in on films, the running bits, really, I call it. Yeah. But I decided I was more of a walker and a reader, and I was pretty well read. I was quite a bookish kid, really. And psychiatry became more and more attractive. And by the time we got to when I'd finished what we call house jobs, and then I did my SHO jobs, I was sure I was going to do psychiatry. And that meant coming to London. I came to the Maudsley, which is the place to train, and I've been there ever since. But it wasn't the plan. But if you'd have known me and you knew about medicine and the way medicine works, you probably would have guessed when I said at 16, I want to do medicine, I'll bet you'll end up at the Maudsley. I'll bet you become an academic. I'll bet you become a professor at the Maudsley, which is what actually happened. But that was never the plan. Hmm. But it suited my personality and character and what I was fascinated by.
I mean, you've had an amazing career so far. You know, the president of the Royal College of Psychiatrists.
Yep.
You won the John Maddox Prize. You've done numerous research, including chronic fatigue syndrome, Gulf War syndrome, and military psychiatry, and also a trustee of combat stress.
Indeed.
But history is really important to you as well, and, yeah, and understanding history. We've just briefly went or overviewed it then with the Kinder transport and your father.
I think there's no question that I got my love of history from my father. That's the inheritance I got. I'm quite certain about that, and it mattered. And one of the great things about psychiatry is that a knowledge of history is not just the kind of accidental thing you can do, you know, as you retire and people, you know, start thinking about what did Mozart die of or what was Darwin's illness or something like that. It's quite fundamental. And I've just spent a year chairing the review of the Mental Health Act for the PM, who she is still the PM. Well, I think she was this morning, wasn't she? I didn't check, but anyway. But I did that. And again, you have to know about the history of psychiatry and coercion and the asylums. And if you don't know about that, you won't understand how we got to the position that we're in. And there's a lot of psychiatry where, you know, how we classify and think about disorders depend upon a knowledge of the history of the profession and where we've come from and where we're going. I don't think that's true of any other speciality in medicine. History is interesting. In psychiatry, it's a necessary knowledge that you need to have, partly to avoid making some of the mistakes we've made in the past.
So have we always, let's talk about the kind of military psychiatry of things. Go way back before even the First World War. Let's go push it right back to the ancients, I suppose. We'll come quickly to the First World War. But has there always been, or when can we kind of date kind of mental health in brackets, PTSD back? Have we always thought about it? Has it always been kind of a thing?
That's a phenomenally difficult question. And the reason is, the answer to the question is, we really don't know. And we don't know because we don't have the sources. We think we do. So I've got colleagues who spend their time reading the Iliad and Homer and all sorts of things to look for cases of psychiatric disorder in the great Greek myths. But, you know, you have to remind them that this is epic poetry translated by verbally for hundreds of years before it even gets written down. These are not medical case notes. Yeah. And they just don't work that way. And we don't know. And I don't think until the middle of the 19th century it's possible to really get kind of into the minds of people's emotions, particularly at war, because, you know, the people who are going to war, the common soldiers, are illiterate. They leave no trace. Even the officers barely leave a trace. I mean, Napoleon's, Nelson's captains are quite literate, and we know quite a lot about how they thought. There's a wonderful book based on their letters and logs as they're proceeding to Trafalgar. They have quite a few hours from the moment that Nelson decides they're going to fight before they actually fight. And they know they're going to fight. And they write letters. They write, I mean, not blogs, obviously. They write in their logs, actually. And it's been beautifully analysed. But you really have to know an awful lot about the period to know what the words they're using mean, because they sound like our words, but they don't mean the same. And it's not until the mid-19th century that you can make something of medical records. You don't get any psychiatry until the mid-19th century. There isn't such a thing as a psychiatrist. They don't exist. So that's why myself and Edgar Jones, a historian that I work very closely with, we haven't ever written anything pre the Crimean War. And we think it's quite dangerous isn't quite the word, but I think it's ill-advised to speculate too much and draw out, you know, people sometimes use Henry IV and Hotspur's speech in Henry IV as an example of PTSD. I think that's pushing it. So we stick with when people start to leave records, when the words like mood, depression, fear, anxiety mean what we think they do. Before that, they often don't.
So what was the early attitudes like then with, you know, Crimea? What was the early attitudes like towards psychiatry and then in relation to kind of anxiety or emotion linked with kind of combat?
I mean, it's quite hard to say. I mean, we know that a lot of it was expressed through physical symptoms. So we know in the American Civil War, for example, and in the Boer War, there certainly were a lot of soldiers who developed lots and lots of symptoms, quite similar to what we would call Gulf War syndrome in modern times. So they were more likely to be articulating what we think might be what we might call psychological distress through physical symptoms. We know that. We certainly know many of them would be handicapped for years to come. From Civil War records, we know that many would end up in asylums during the 19th century. Whether or not that was related to war is quite difficult to say. Certainly some would get war pensions start to be paid during the Civil War period a little bit. But really, the big change is the First World War. There's no doubt about that. What there is arguments about is exactly what changed. But the First World War is a change because shell shock arrives 1914. First described in 15 by Charles Myers, and they wrote about it in The Lancet. And there's two things to say about that. Number one, shell shock is not PTSD. And everyone says shell shock, that's what we now call PTSD. But if you read about it, what they're talking about was what we would call more neurological symptoms. So you find huge numbers of accounts of people who suddenly go blind or can't speak or can't hear. And they shake, and they have huge tremors and really bizarre movement disorders and very strange walks and things like that. Now, we do see that a little bit. I think we saw three cases in Afghanistan of what, you know, that generation would say, oh, that's shell shock. Mm. But what they didn't have in the First World War was, again, when I talk about PTSD, and you've had Walter talking about it, everyone thinks about shell shock, they immediately think about the flashback. I'm walking down the street, a car backfires, and I'm back in Nam. That's a kind of classic flashback. And try as we might, we can find hardly any descriptions in the First World War of the flashback. We find a few, but very few. Now, nearly everybody describes that, and very few describe the kind of classic neurological symptoms. So we think it changes. We think it's a different disorder, or at least it mutates in the 20th century into what we see now. Why it does that? We have a few theories, but we can't prove any of them, but they're quite fun, but we don't know why.
Mm.
But I mean, we are quite sure that they're not the same thing.
So shell shock, because it was such widespread and it became an almost epidemic for the British, Army and the, well, I suppose everyone in the trenches. What was the initial treatments for it, and then how did that progress?
Yeah, it's very important to make the first point is it did become an epidemic, and by 1916 it was part of the major manpower crisis around the Somme. The same happened to the French, same happened to the Germans, exactly the same.
Same symptoms.
Yes, similar symptoms for sure, and a similar realization that this was a real problem for all of them.
Mm.
But there wasn't a single view of shell shock. Very at the start, it was called shell shock because they actually thought it was what we would now call concussion. Or
like a pressure change or something.
Yes,
or...
they did think that, yeah. Okay. And what we would now call mild traumatic brain injury was closer to the original description of shell shock. And they thought it was the pressure changes of the exploding shell nearby rattling the brain. They thought it could kill, and there were cases that were largely anecdotal, but of people being found in trenches completely dead, but with no injury at all. And it was thought that maybe their oxygen had been sucked out and they'd suffocated, which I think that was more mythological than anything else. It didn't take long before they realised that there was something psychological about it, because you could get it without being anywhere near a shell, but the name shell shock stuck. But people were getting this who hadn't been exposed to a shell. And the cost of industrialised warfare was getting so terrible that it was quite hard to close your eyes to the idea this could be a psychological issue. But the problem they had then was the numbers were getting huge, and the treatments were simply not working. And they tried everything. There's no single treatment at any one time. They used to send them back to England, first of all, like they did serious physical casualties. But that really didn't work. The asylums got full with shell shock victims. Same happened in Germany. And the Germans said that if you cross the Rhine with what they call Kriegneurosen, war neurosis, you never came back. And it was the same if you crossed the Channel.
Okay.
So they change. And what they do then in 16 is they start to treat people quickly, as quickly as they could. And everyone thinks when you talk about shell shock, they think about places like Craig Lockhart, this lovely country house on the outskirts of Edinburgh, full of officers writing poetry, doing basket weaving and walking in the woods. That is so exceptional that it bears virtually no relationship to the way the vast majority of people were treated. And they were treated in huge tented camps. And have you ever done the tunnel? Have you gone through on the Eurotunnel?
Yeah.
Yeah. When you come out, the first thing most of us do is go to the Leclerc supermarket, that huge supermarket.
Yeah.
And That's Shell Shock Hospital number 5.
Really?
Yes, that's where it was. It's exactly where it was. It's where the Ela clerk is as you come out of the tunnel. First place everybody stops in to buy the wine and things like that. Yeah. There were 5,000 people there at any one time. Now, they weren't getting psychotherapy and talking to Rivers. They were getting a bit of exercise, clean food, sleep, food, and a kind of vague exhortation to be a man and go back and do your duty. Very crude psychotherapy. That was the reality, but it was done quickly. And it was done as near as they could to the front line. And it was done also with the expectancy that you would get better. And from this, that's the birth of modern psychiatry. Everybody who does home treatment or crisis intervention is practicing what they called forward psychiatry in 1916, 17. Mm. That's where it comes from.
Was that developing then as we were going?
Mm.
Was the psychiatrist there? Was the professional? Well, there
were,
there?
But they didn't call themselves. Really fascinating. They didn't call themselves psychiatrists because psychiatry was what the asylums did. The asylum doctors were the psychiatrists. They dealt with the schizophrenia, and which they were just calling schizophrenia then, general paralysis of the insane, and what we would now, and manic depression, which we now call bipolar. But the doctors who were doing this called themselves psychologists. But they were psychiatrists. They were medically trained. Mm. But psychiatry was such a stigmatized word and also not really recognized. It went with the asylum, the lunatic trade. It was called the lunatic trade. So the ones who we know about all almost invariably call themselves psychologists. But then there came the real problem. And this is a part of history most people are really unaware of. The numbers were still huge. And the army and the doctors started to think that really we're making this too easy. There are too many cases of shell shock. And it's either people are either unconsciously trying to get away from the war, you know, not entirely surprisingly, or even consciously. In other words, some of them they thought were frankly malingering. Myers, who'd invented shell shock, was fired. New guys came in who were much tougher. And by 1917, they banned shell shock. So the word was banned. You can't use it. And it's never been used since in medicine or in the military.
Was it a medical term?
It had been.
Oh, really?
Yeah. When Myers, it was in the Lancet and it was a diagnosis. But in 17, Myers is dismissed. I think in 16, a guy called Gordon Holmes, who even his best friends didn't like him, a tough neurologist from just down the road from here, from where we're talking, at National Hospital for Neurology. He basically thought that it was cowardice. He really did. And indeed, he would say so after the war. So the treatments got tougher. Not the myth that they were all shot. That's just not true. But they got quicker, tougher, shorter, and more military. Mm. As a way of trying to combat the epidemic, exactly the same happened on the German side as well. There was a big kind of switch. And at the end of the war, they had to think what had gone wrong, because they were now paying, you know, tens of thousands of pensions for shell shock. They knew it had been a real problem. Many thought, had it continued, they'd have lost the war. Germans thought the same. Mm. So they had a Royal Commission, which is what we do. I mean, I've just led what those days would have been a Royal Commission on the Mental Health Act, but they had one on shell shock. And they finally concluded that shell shock was not a legitimate illness, that really it didn't happen where units were well led, where people were properly trained, properly selected. They thought it was a form of contagion and also what we call secondary gain.
So a direct kind of correlation between someone's moral fibre or being a man to, you know, when you talked about selection there.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
I mean, you know, they really did think, and I think one of them actually used the phrase, we need to select the right stuff.
You look at Wilfred Owen. Did he win the Military Cross, didn't he?
He did, yeah.
And he's probably the
fundamentally brave man.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. But what they had that problem, and they also had to consider the issue of cowardice, which we don't talk about now at all, but they did, and they had to. And they had to also look at the fact that they had executed, you know, 250 soldiers for military offences. Very small number with cowardice, and an even smaller number with shell shock, but it had happened. And how did they tell the difference between cowardice and mental breakdown? And it was a real problem for them. Finally, they just said anyone who has proven their courage cannot be guilty of cowardice. That was the best they could do. But what they also said, because they were fundamentally Victorians and Edwardians, and they believed that character was essential, and that fundamentally shell shock was a failure of character. And so when we get to 1939, and we know the war's coming, at the beginning of 1939, we have another committee that says, what are we going to do with war neurosis, as they were now calling it? What are we going to do? How are we going to avoid the shell shock problems that we had? And they say, shell shock, absolutely banned. The label is dead and buried. It's gone. We're not going to give it a label. We will not allow anyone to leave the armed forces for a psychiatric reason, and we will not pay a single war pension.
During this,
that's how they start the war.
Go back to Craig Lockhart Hospital, and then Maudsley as well, I suppose. Yeah. There's direct links, but the Craig Lockhart. What was going on there? What were they developing there? Why was it so different there? You know, there was encouraging things like poetry and nature and being almost relaxed and decompressed.
They did a lot of things there, actually. Again, there wasn't one Craig Lockhart. There was a couple of the consultants. In fact, the one who treated Owen was quite famous for being a great believer in what was called ergotherapy, which was basically work, or what we now call occupational therapy. Mm. We have Rivers, very famous, lovely man, who was a psychoanalyst, and he believed in talking therapies, basically, and would be quite influential, but only for a small number of people. And he treated a very, very small number of people. His caseload was very small. But, of course, he treated Sassoon, who didn't have shell shock, and has been very influential since then. But it's important to remember, as I say, the number of people who got that kind of talking therapy over a period of time to encourage that kind of literary sensibilities is tiny, compared to the 5,000 people in each of the five shell shock hospitals. That was not how the ranks were treated. There was a huge class divide. I mean, a really huge class divide. I mean, you're a veteran, I know, but it's still big class divides in the military. It was huge in those days. Even diagnosis was about class. But the other thing is that all of the doctors still had only one thing, and their job was to get people back to the war. People forget that. Rivers supported the war, and his job, he did it in a different way. He persuaded Sassoon to go back to the conflict. Mm. The others persuaded Owen to go back to the conflict, not to let down their men, that kind of stuff. So they were not anti-war at all, and it's wrong to portray them that way.
And then, what was post 18? So Maudsley then became more of that.
Yeah.
Followed that work through. Mm. So the questions I'm going to ask is, what did we learn from that, or did it become more difficult? It sounded like we were being progressive, and then it became...
It's a huge mistake to think that shell shock is the beginning of our contemporary enlightenment, and there is a straight road from shell shock to PTSD. There isn't. The Second World War is actually more influential. Now, they start with this doctrine, which the Germans had the same, the Russians had the same. We stopped shooting people, by the way, and the Germans started it. They didn't really do it in the First War, but they did in the Second, as we know, and the Russians even worse. But we can't hold that line. So by Dunkirk in 1940, MPs, most of whom are in uniform, say, look, this is ridiculous. This is too harsh. We are we're seeing people breaking down, and we can't treat them this way. So we back away, and then we slowly rediscover the other lessons of the First World War. We've got to treat people quickly, immediately, with the expectancy of recovery. We set up a system of forward psychiatry, which we use in Normandy, try and use in Italy, but it doesn't really work, but it does a bit better in Normandy. And we do finally allow people to be discharged, and we will pay war pensions. And finally, at the end, we and the Americans agree. The Americans have got by this time some fantastic data that we haven't got, that every man has his breaking point. In a condition of continuous infantry fighting, most units will be combat ineffective after, I think it's 144 days, through psychiatric reasons. And the two things come from the Second World War is that actually, yes, people can only take so much, which was not the First World War view. It was about if you have good character, you might have a breakdown, but you get better. In the Second World War, we realized that actually, finally, most people, if pushed, if you do one tour of bomber command, 50% of you will either be dead or psychiatrically ineffective. So that changes. And we also realize, what is it that makes people fight? In the First World War, we believed it was due to patriotism, which is why people join. But in the Second World War comes overwhelming evidence that people actually fight for their mates. Hence, we have the platoon. We have the whole you know, coming from the Americans, which hasn't changed to this day at all, the realization that actually what really matters is the support of the 10, 12 people around you. And that becomes absolutely standard doctrine of combat motivation and of demotivation. You will break down when that support breaks down.
Mm. And from the First World War and the Second World War, post the Second World War, the PTSD was still a thing in the brain. It was still happening to people's brain, wasn't it? It wasn't like it's been made up in the last 20 years.
No, you're right. But we're arguing that it took different shapes and forms. And what we think that the flashback, for example, we think is a nature in the change of traumatic memory that happens after the First World War. And it happens, we think, we can't prove this, but we think it's due to the fact that after the First World War, it's the era of mass cinema. Everybody goes to the cinema 3-4 times a week, even if they're very working class, whatever. And if you look at even early war films, so often a war film depends upon a flashback. You think of every film Steven Spielberg's ever made. It's all about flashbacks. And we wonder if that changes the nature of traumatic memory. So previously, people, when we read their records from the First World War, they talk about nightmares, they talk about depression, they talk about, they even talk about impotence. But they don't talk about flashbacks. But then by the end of the century, they do start talking about flashbacks. And we wonder if just the cinema changes the way in which we think about trauma. Can't prove that, but I can't disprove it either. And it's quite fun. But we wonder if that's what happened. That there is a change is quite clear. We don't see those First World War films of people with these gross neurological disorders that are clearly psychologically induced. Mm. But we just I've seen two in Afghanistan, but only two. And there they were seeing thousands of them. So something has changed. Mm. But really, what finally changes in 1980, we then have the diagnosis of PTSD. Oh. And this comes from America. And it comes for a different reason, is that people say, oh, well, that's when we finally acknowledge the psychological cost of war. Well, that's complete nonsense, because the First World War knew that. The Second World War knew that. They had, you know, tens of thousands of casualties, psychiatric casualties, filling these hospitals. In the Second World War, they had actually a higher rate of psychiatric casualties in the Second World War to the First World War. But what they said was this, and they said that if you break down in war, and you are basically of good character in the First World War, that's what they called it, but later on they would change to say, you know, you had, well, you had, you had good parents, or you were brought up, you had a stable personality, whatever. And the causes of the war, you would get better. But if you don't get better, and if you stay ill for a prolonged period of time, or you keep relapsing, probably the war wasn't really the cause. It was just the trigger. And the real cause was what we would now call genetics. They call it hereditary, or your upbringing, if you were, you know, more psychoanalytically inclined, the way your parents brought you up. And then it was, you know, the war was merely the trigger. And that is the doctrine. That's what changes in 1980 with PTSD, huge change. The Americans start to say long-term illness in American veterans, Vietnam veterans, is also due to the war. And that's what's different about PTSD. People have a great misunderstanding of what it is. But it's saying that you can be ill for many years and the cause of your illness remains your war experiences. That was not what they thought in the First and Second World War.
Mm.
So it's a big change.
And is that when we started really developing in practices and therapies?
Yes, we do. And the Americans lead on this because we aren't in Vietnam. And PTSD comes into British thinking because of civilian disasters in the 90s. So Hillsborough, Herald of Free Enterprise, Bradford Fire, the King's Cross Fire, that has an impact for us. We don't pay much attention to PTSD when it first arrives because we say, well, it's an American thing, you know? And of course it was an American thing. We weren't in Vietnam, and some of us think it's how Americans are coping with the trauma of losing, and it's a way of trying to reintegrate the Vietnam veteran who has been, not supported by the public, spat upon in public, which did happen, not as often as people think, but in general, the Americans do support their veterans. But nevertheless, there's a lot of them and they're disillusioned, disaffected, drug addicted, dangerous, depressed, and they need help. And PTSD is the way they will get help. And also that they will get support and also pity, which I don't think is actually what was intended, but that's what happens. And it takes a while before we will pay attention to that because we don't think it's relevant to us.
And when did we see it, apart from the civilian population, but where the military population, when did we start
Or
when we start taking note of people? Did we go right back to the Second World War?
Yeah, we Korea, certainly... Or? We, in general, because during that period, our main occupation, as you know, is counter-terrorism operations in Northern Ireland. We're not fighting the kind of war that we'd fought before, and we didn't think that we would get... very high rates of psychiatric issues. And in fact, we didn't get very high rates of psychiatric issues. We did get some. And of course, the Falklands gradually will have an impact, but not immediately, but later on.
Is that because of stigmas and taboos? Or what?
Well, I think it's partly stigma, but I think it's also because we continue to think that that if you, and it's not untrue, actually, that if you come back from deployment and you're okay, you'll largely stay okay. And that's still pretty true. Even our data suggests that actually it's not entirely true. But it's still the case that the main predictor of long-term illness is short-term illness. And that hasn't changed. But it's also because attitudes change. We are influenced by the Americans. There's a huge legal case at the 2003 which says that the military have not caused PTSD. I mean, the cause of PTSD in that was either, you know, Gerry Adams and the IRA or Galtieri in the Falklands. But it's got to change the way it recognises and treats it, which it does.
Mm.
And that legal case does generate a change that we're going to do much more. We are going to take it more seriously. We are going to do more research and reflecting the attitudes in society as well.
Mm. I mean, one thing that I'm getting is everything's changing. Conflict has changed.
Yeah. Yeah.
The mentality's changed. The way media's been put out there has changed. And absolutely one thing that has changed over the last 20 years is conflict and the way that our troops have been used in conflict.
Yeah.
The 6 months on, 18 months off, the 6 months back on again. I don't think that's ever been especially documented in the way and used in the way it has. And what we're seeing from that kind of intense war fighting, especially in Afghan in that kind of 2007 for maybe 8 years.
Sure.
A lot of the infantry lads, especially a lot of the frontline guys, is 6 months on, 18 months off, 6 months back on again. How is that?
Well, we've done a lot of work on that, and it's absolutely fascinating. I think the first thing to say is that you've got to be careful not to rely too much on the experience of World War One and Two, where you're dealing with a huge army, many of whom are conscripted, and you cannot compare that to a all-volunteer, very small professional army is what we have now. They are different. And the experiences they're getting are different. We don't really have, again, the kind of war of attrition that we'll have in the Pacific, Americans have in the Pacific, or Bomber Command. And one of the reasons why we do have the 6 months on, 18 months off, is because the data from the Second World War, where you joined for the duration and you start, you know, if you go on D-Day, you will probably go through, so long as you survive, right through to the Rhine and right through to Germany. We know that that has a huge psychological toll. And so we change, and the Americans change as well. And in Vietnam, you had one tour of duty, which was 1 year, and then that's it. You've done your duty, and you go home. Now, they thought that would completely solve the problem of psychiatric disorder. Of course, it didn't, but that's what they thought. But it's still the influence that we have. That's why we have 6 months on, 18 months off. The Americans have 1 year on, 1 year off. And we did show that 1 year, certainly what's one of the considerable reasons why the Americans have higher rates of PTSD than we do, is because they have this shorter, longer tour of duty and shorter downtime. When we, and the other thing that they started doing during Iraq was they started extending that. So you'd be there for 12 months and then you would extend to 15. And their rates soared. And we did the same with the Black Watch, for example, around Fallujah, where we extended tour, and we never did that again because we were able to show that even a very small change in tour length against expectation had a very big impact.
Ah, the expectation.
It was about expectation, yeah. And that's one of the reasons why we didn't extend tour length.
We spoke on this before about Sangin, where the lads were literally getting on their their flights home and they were told, bang, off you go, another month, or at least another month of fighting, quite fierce fighting.
No, well...
And I know that's impacted a lot of, especially the Royal Marines.
We tried really hard to avoid that. We really did, because it's all about... It really is about expectation, and the advice we gave was, if you are going to alter tour length, you mustn't do it during a tour. People need to know, and families need to know as well. And that kind of date becomes almost sacred. And it was quite substantial, the change in people's attitudes and health and drink later on, alcohol problems, PTSD, etc., with quite a small change. And it wasn't about the length, it was about the change. And I do think we've tried very hard to stick to a specific tour length. Now, of course, some do much longer. You know, people in headquarters may do much longer tours, but those are very different experiences, and I don't think they're comparable.
Mm. But, just one thing I've just popped into my mind there. I want to go back and then come forward again. When you said about the HQ, is nurses in the First World War, did they show signs of shell shock like the troops did? And then are we seeing that now from Afghan, Iraq, where nurses or people who are casualty handling, are they experiencing the same symptoms and trauma?
It's a very good question, to which I'm not sure what the answer is. I know that RAMC lost 10% of its strength killed. So the doctors and nurses as well.
From the First World War?
In the First World War, 10%, which is roughly the same as infantry. They were very forward, and now 10% of everyone in the RMC is killed, which is the same. Yeah. I don't know what the figure is for nurses. They're likely to be a bit further back, and I think the answer is I don't know. I do know now that originally we did show a slightly higher rate of mental health problems in those in all medic personnel, including nurses. Although when we repeated the study in Afghan, we didn't show that. So there was a slight increase. Certainly, some of them do get disorders. Yes, absolutely, they do. That's quite correct. In general, though, when we've looked at different groups, the main thing we know is the two groups that have worse problems are reserves, twice the rate of psychiatric problems to regulars, and those in direct combat roles, again, have an increase in PTSD, which isn't really surprising, is it?
But why is it so high in reserve? So reserves who have experienced
all reserves. When the first studies we did showed that if you take the whole force, there's no increase in the regulars overall in the rate of disorders for those who've been to Iraq, Afghanistan, compared to those who haven't. There's two reasons for that. One, as you know, a huge number of people in combat support different roles. Second, because we have to compare like with like. We cannot compare civilians with the military. It's a meaningless comparison. And therefore, there hasn't been a time in recent years when we have a proper non-combat, non-deployed, non-exposed control group, because they're doing lots of other things. Mm. But reserves, we showed just simply going to deploy, double the rate of psychiatric disorder. But let's be clear, it went from 3 to 6%. It's not 30 to 60%. The vast majority came back well. But purely deploying did increase the rate of disorders, and that was still present 5 years later. And I think that's still the case now, I'm afraid. And we think it's to do with homecoming. It's not to do with what happens in theatre. It's the great difficulties that reserves have in homecoming compared to regulars.
In what way? As in going back in and not being around that group?
Yeah, yeah. It's the things that help you adjust when you come back. You can see people like me, well, not like me, but my colleagues. There's lots of formal social support. There's people like Padres, kind of in between. But what really matters is the informal social support you get from families, your mates.
Barbecues going on, everyone living together.
Chain of command, all of these things. And of course, by definition, the regulars don't get that because they're not... The reserves don't get that. And here's the paradox. In order to reduce the rate of psychiatric casualties for the reserves, you're going to have to make them look like regulars. And then the whole point of them is gone.
Yeah.
And that's a wicked problem. I don't think there's a solution to that. I don't know it. I mean, I remember my hospital, we're quite friendly towards, well, we're very friendly towards the armed forces and just my universities as well. And but when people come back, who've been reserves for a little bit of time, everyone's terribly interested, etc. But it doesn't take very long before, like, if you're a medic, a doctor, you'll say, well, whilst you're away, I had to do all your on-call and we had yet another reorganisation of the health service, and you forget about it. Whereas obviously if you're a regular, when you come back, the one thing you do know is that your employer, the army or whatever, does approve of what you've done.
Yeah.
And that's not the case. We try to make it the case, but fundamentally it isn't really for civilians. It's not the same. And then there's a support from your mates, from your colleagues, and from your family. You know, if you're living in a garrison town, it's very different to if you, you know, way out on your own, as it were.
The if we make the comparison between World War One and recent conflicts with family, with a role that maybe a wife or a partner would have had. First World War, things changed a lot post-conflict, where a daughter may have to look after their father, a wife, their plans would change and it'd be all about the man in the house. And then we fast forward to Afghan. What are we seeing the impact, or are we seeing an impact in the family, sons and daughters and wives and their future?
Yeah, and it's a really good question. First of all, again, comparison to the First War are very difficult because we've got millions coming back. There was a lot of concerns about how veterans would be in the Second World War, for example. Spouses would get, and it would be the spouse, by the way, because if you weren't married, you didn't count.
Yeah.
But it was assumed that you were married. Got a booklet about the problems that their returning husband would have. Same with America. And you read them, they're written in a way that now sound a bit kind of Harry Enfield-ish.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, they're pointing out the problems they'll have with integration. There might be problems with violence and things like that. They're there. So they knew there were problems. Now, obviously, there is more done for families. If you look at the impact, the first thing to say is that it's not true to say that going to deploy leads to greater breakdown. So we had a look and we looked at after Iraq, 7% of relationships broke down in the 6 months after Iraq, but 7% broke down in those who hadn't been to Iraq. And then we look at children. Now, we know overall military children have higher rates of mental health problems, conduct disorders or ADHD if they're young, anxiety, depression if they're older. And we were able to have a look and see, well, why? Now, one thing people say is, well, it's about deployment, it's about separation. But we've shown conclusively it's not about separation. They handle separation very well. Goes with the territory. They get used to it. They often find families, you know, not every single soldier is a perfect father or Sir Lancelot or Sir Galahad. Some families function better. So that's not the issue. But what is the issue is when the partner, and it is still, let's be honest, still usually the father, but not entirely, comes back with drink or mental health problems, PTSD, then that's why you have the higher rates in children. So it's not deployment per se, it's coming back with mental health problems that's affecting the child.
So it's the impact that the mental health or PTSD from the father has on the children.
That's exactly right. And I think that's quite important because of the kind of policy implication. It's not the separation. It's when that separation is associated with you developing problems. And then that will be transmitted back to the family.
I think it's a really valuable thing as well, and knowing that there is a responsibility to look after ourselves, and I say our as in serving personnel or guys who have left, and that understanding that you're having a direct impact, all your actions, good and bad, are having a direct impact on your children and the long term mental well being of your child as well, especially if you've been in a frontline role or you've got a higher risk of things like PTSD.
Definitely.
And now, what you've taught me today is that reservist, really looking after yourself, and the understanding that if you're a reservist, it can
increase. Good CEOs know that, and they will do the best they can to maintain those bonds. And it's those social support bonds that are so important. And good ones will organise all sorts of funny things, really, really, just to get the folks back together.
Yeah.
So they can, decompress, as it were. They do go through decompression, but decompression is quite a short thing. We know it's helpful, but it's by no means enough. but it's helpful. But that's the kind of thing that continually goes on with people who've served and in the informal way. And of course, we have the TRIM system that we help set up and evaluate that is, again, always about, you don't come to people like me, psychiatrists, counselors, psychologists, until it's absolutely necessary. The first line of defense is you and your mates. Then it's people like the Padres, chain of command. We are there really for the small number who've developed PTSD, which needs treatment. But people who come back, you know, with emotional problems, et cetera, or don't, you know, they're not mentally ill, but they need support and help. And that should come from absolutely within the unit, within the family, within the existing social structures.
Because if we can hit it hard initially, it will help long term.
Well, it's what the young royal princes are talking about. It's that, you know, these are not disorders, but it's good to talk. It's good to share, but with people who understand you at a time and a place of your choosing. Very important. You know, some people don't like talking straight away. That's fine. There's no right way to do it.
I think that's why this podcast has impacted a lot of people. It's not the speaking. It's not always actually listening to someone else's situation, experiences, as well as a professional's kind of guidance as well.
And what we found, this is why the military sometimes get annoyed with us, is that there's no single solution. So going back to when people came back from Grapple from Bosnia, we did a study to look at who did people want to talk to. And it turned out, first of all, some just didn't want to talk. They just didn't want to. Mm. Others definitely would only talk to their family. Others absolutely definitely would not talk to their family, would only talk to people who they knew in their unit. Others wanted to talk to people who'd had similar experiences but weren't in their unit. Some wanted to talk to padres. Some said definitely not. And there was no, you know, the military wanted us to say, this is who you should talk to at this time. And we said, no, you can't do that. You've got to have a whole range of options, and you've also got to allow people to make the choices that they're most comfortable with.
Mm. Where are we at now then with things like psychiatric first aid?
Yeah, I mean, these are all variations on a theme. TRIM is what we use, which is really very similar.
Right,
the idea is that you give everybody or a lot of people really very basic knowledge in spotting when people are in trouble. And let's be honest, it's not very subtle. It's like, you know, if someone's drinking too much or not talking, and then what you might do. In my experience of it, most people actually know that already. All we've done is say, look, it's not difficult. It's okay to talk. It's okay to ask how you're doing. You can even ask, are you thinking of doing something stupid? And people get very frightened. They say, well, I'll ask the wrong thing. I'll say the wrong thing and I'll make it all worse. I say, no, you won't. Honestly, it's okay. And that's a lot of it. It's just giving people permission. And then they say, oh, yeah, I can do that. You say, yeah, you don't need to spend 6 years at medical school, 7 years doing psychiatry. Now, when someone has something like PTSD, yeah, you do. But most haven't. And it's spotting those who are going to need the next level.
What's the future of military mental health and the future of it, the treatment of it, what we're doing to counteract some of the negatives?
Well, I think there's two issues there. One is that our treatments have improved, that's for sure, and there will probably be new, for example, drug treatments will be appearing, which will help. There's, you know, a lot of stuff going on, particularly in America, where they've got huge funds that we don't have and are spending huge amounts to try and find more biological markers for PTSD and treatments. That's fine. Will that solve the problem? No, it won't. And always we'll have to mix in the psychological and social with the physical treatments. They will not be able to separate, because some of the issues we're talking about won't be solved by taking a drug. Some will. I think the other thing that worries me a lot is the way in which there's a lack of understanding of what really goes on with people who've served. And I'm worried if the public now tend to see everyone who's served, they're a hero. And you and I know, you in particular, not me, know that most are not heroes. They're professionals, but they're not heroes. Some are, but most aren't. They're doing a job. Or they're victims, which is equally wrong.
Mm.
And there's a view that, you know, something like 80% of the population believe that if you served in Iraq and Afghanistan, you are very likely to come back with physical and mental problems. The answer is you're not very likely to come back with physical and mental problems. You may come back, but you're not very likely. And obviously, our job is to help those who have far better. But if we end up thinking, as the Americans have done more, particularly with Vietnam, that everyone who's served will ultimately succumb, and that the being in the armed forces is a toxic occupation, that's probably the most dangerous thing we can do. And we need to have a proper view, which actually, for many people, is the best thing they've done. It's the best time of their lives. And they remain, and they will end up as better citizens. We've shown that. We look at offending rates, for example. If you've served, your chances of getting a criminal record are dramatically reduced. Not increased, reduced. People forget that. Unfortunately, you do also have more violent offending. That's the downside. You're more likely to be convicted for a violent offence. But overall, you're less likely to be convicted for everything. Most veterans will get employment and do very well. We need to, you know, push that message. This is not a toxic occupation. People do not need our pity, but they may need support.
Mm.
And I think that's probably the most dangerous thing that really worries me.
Mm. We're seeing it again and again with we're not going to go into it now, but with post-traumatic growth, with post-conflict growth as well, people who have experienced the bad can really grow and really and add to society, add to en masse, on that national asset kind of level, where these our service leavers can really impact business, society, the charitable sector. And
I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, we published a paper asking people about, you know, the positive and negative side. One of the commonest things they endorsed was, as a result of my deployment, I now handle stress better. Not worse, but better. And we had a paper years ago, which I remember, was interviewing someone who had been in Bosnia on Op Grapple, which was a nasty operation and very difficult. And I was talking to this guy, and then he suddenly leaned over and he said, do you know what was the best thing about that operation? I said, I don't know. He said it was this, he said, Doc. He said, serving in Bosnia made me appreciate living in Bristol. And I think we used it as a title of a paper.
Yeah, yes. Brilliant.
Yes.
Simon, I really appreciate your time coming in today. Thank you very much. And we will leave it there.